Hey, it's Andrew Siciliano. Coming up on Inside Coverage on Yahoo, what do the Jets do at 2, and how does it affect the rest of the draft? Are the Cowboys really trading up? Is Reuben Bain really falling down? And who was the best quarterback today at Browns minicamp? Jory Epstein was there, she'll tell you. Frank Schwab is here with us as well. He wrote a great column. Inside Coverage is next. We are like 48 hours away. It's almost here, I promise. Welcome to another edition of Inside Coverage on Yahoo, the how and the why, any and everything that you need to know about the National Football League. We're recording this here on a Wednesday. That's a Tuesday. Well, whatever it is. It's a couple of days before the draft. How about that? The annual selection meeting. My name is Andrew Siciliano. I am flattered, I am honored, I am touched, I am moved to be joined by my two dear friends, Yahoo senior NFL writers, or senior Yahoo, no, Yahoo. You're not senior, you're Frank senior NFL senior. Writers.
Hey.
No, right, Jory. Well, Jory definitely isn't senior. That's Frank Schwab and that's Jory Epstein. How are you guys?
Doing well. Doing 48 great. Hours away. I didn't realize you were so excited about game 3 of Knicks and Hawks, but hey, that's cool. Hey, oh, you're yeah. talking about the
oh, dad jokes showing he's a senior.
Hey, see, now you're hey, showing now. The senior NFL writer part of this, right?
I have never denied that I'm old.
I actually am excited. And we talked about this a little bit in Monday's episode. I am excited because people say, well, it's not a great draft. Blue chips and future stars and all that. And I would push back because you never know. But I'm excited because we don't know. We don't know anything beyond pick number one. And to me, that makes it a fun draft. It's not just a draft show, I promise you. It's also a football show because Jory is in Cleveland today. She's actually, this is going to sound creepy, you might be even be in a room that I've been in before. You're at the hotel that I always stay in when I'm in Cleveland. You're in Cleveland. Todd Monken had the Browns on the field today for actual football, not OTAs. This is a voluntary mini camp. Miles isn't there, right? It's not mandatory. A voluntary mini camp that the new head coaches, and there are 10 of them, get. So you actually watched football today.
Yeah, there was football. There was 7-on-7. There was 11-on-11. I mean, we were actually playing. By we, I mean they, the royal we.
Right. Did you,
I was not playing. I almost got hit by the football a couple times, but I was not playing football.
It's the idea that you got hit by football, is that a storyline? Because the quarterbacks are a storyline. We'll talk about this a little bit later, but it's the Shador Sanders, Deshaun Watson, Dylan Gabriel quarterback derby. You getting almost hit by a football, is that part of a quarterback evaluation?
Right, because if they were trying to hit me, they missed, and we want accuracy from our quarterbacks.
It's too early for this, by the way. Football, we haven't even gotten to the first month of the baseball season.
I was going to say.
How are we having football practice? Come on.
I've actually never been to a mini camp this early. I'm laughing because I was at the Browns for training camp a couple of years in August, and then last year I came for mandatory mini camp in June. Now I'm here in April, so I guess I need to come to them in February next year. But I guess because when I covered the Cowboys, the only time they had a new coach in my 7 years living in Dallas covering them, it was COVID and Mike McCarthy, and so there was no new mini camp. So I was definitely never seeing any practices in April before this.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of felt weird because the Browns went from phase one straight to phase three. They skipped phase two, and they're allowed to do this. And all the new head coaches, again, can get an extra voluntary minicamp. Munkin was the one. And the Steelers are doing it, too. The Steelers, at least Mike McCarthy has his guys in there. You know, the Steelers, the Browns were going like, yeah, we'll do it. We'll do a draft week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And I think some people went, oh, really? Yes, really. All right, more from Jory coming up in about a half hour as to what she did see today and what Shador Sanders and the quarterbacks had to say today. But we begin this show with manna from the heavens. Frank Schwab's top draft storylines, which dropped this morning on the Yahoo NFL page. And like I said before, this to me is a very exciting draft. It's exciting because of the unknown. We do know the one known, Frank, is that Fernando Mendoza is going number one. He's not going to be in Pittsburgh, told Rich Eisen on Monday that because of his mother's health issues, he wants to be at home with the family, and then he's going to get on a private jet anyway and go straight to Vegas. But that's the one known. We don't know what's going to happen at two. You have it as one of your 12 draft storylines, the Jets' choice, which we assume is Arvell Reese and David Bailey.
Yeah, it seems to be down to those two. I mean, if you listen to all the buzz, which doesn't always come to pass, because look what happened with the second pick last year when there was a last second trade with Travis Hunter. But I think that it's not just the second pick with the Jets. It's four picks in the top 44. Like, they made the decision, hey, we're hitting a reset button. We're trading Sauce Gardner. We're trading Quinnen Williams. All right, now you got to hit the picks. And that's not easy in this draft. And I think that does start at number two. And I thought it was really, really interesting. If you go back a couple of weeks on Football 301, Nate and Charles, our colleagues, had a really interesting conversation about what the Jets should do at two. And they brought up, like, Arvell Reese is great because you can move him around. You can be very flexible with him. You can be very creative with him. Well, Aaron Glenn's not really that type of defensive coach. He's not the type of coach that's moving guys around. So really, this is almost like a line in the sand with the Jets of, do we draft a guy for Aaron Glenn? David Bailey is probably the better fit, I would assume. But Aaron Glenn's on the hot seat. We don't know if Aaron Glenn's going to be here next year. Or do we draft Arvell Reese, who has the higher upside? When all this stuff was starting to come out, David Bailey started to become like a hot name to the Jets. Oh, David Bailey. I want to say that probably there's probably some people in the Jets coaching staff that were pushing that maybe to these leaks, because he's the guy that could help them right away, help them win games, and maybe save their jobs. But yes, I believe it's Reese, but it's going to be very interesting, because I think it's not just the player. It is also an organizational philosophy almost of, hey, Reese doesn't really fit what Glenn wants to do, but this is the right pick and we're going to make it.
Yeah, it's funny because Jets beat writer Zach Rosenblatt, who does a good job, was at Darren Mucci's press conference today and reporting on why the Jets canceled their 30 visit with David Bailey. And they had asked him, oh, is this a smokescreen? And of course, the team always says, oh, but we had enough touch points. But I think to me, there is this question of, do you want someone who's ready to contribute as a pass rusher and probably as a quarterback sacker in 2026 maximally? Or do you want someone who has the most upside as a versatile defender, even positionless in terms of what they can likely do in Arvell Reese, but maybe most of that comes closer to 2027? And I think there's also the element, and I know we're going to get to the trades, but like, if you're the Jets and you like them both and you feel like they're both going to be around later, what does that mean when six teams have multiple first round picks right now? There's a lot of potential movement. But I think what it really comes down to is that the Jets know that their defense was terrible last year. The zero interceptions was not only the reflection of the secondary, it's also about the marriage of the rush and coverage. And if you're not getting pressure on the quarterback, it's much harder for the guys in the secondary to do their job. Then they go and get rid of Quinnen Williams, their defensive tackle, their all-pro. They send Sauce Gardner to Indianapolis. Both of those guys drew picks in return. And now you know that if you were going to really hemorrhage your defense last year, you need to make sure that you're replacing it, I would say, with probably at least two of the three picks that they have in the top 40. And again, that could look different in terms of if they move up and package them, but I would want the value of at least two of the three in the top 40 going to defense.
So they have 16, as we know. So 2 and 16, just laying these picks out. They have 33. So the number one pick in the second round. Last year, that number one pick in the second round was the defensive rookie of the year in Carson Schwessinger. And then they have, from the Quinnen Williams trade, as you pointed out, they have 44. So they could get good players. My big question here is, and you guys are both right, you're both dead on as to, are they going to try to win this year, they try to win next year. I don't think they're going to win either year, but at least next year in 27, they have the shot to drop in their quarterback. Right?
Yeah.
They have the three number ones next year. Could they get Arch Manning? Could they get whomever? Like, whoever it is. And then this team is rip-roaring and ready to go with five first-round picks in 2 years, and these guys all hopefully contribute.
You guys aren't on board with the whole Ty Simpson idea with the Jets.
Not in the first round.
What
if you
want
to take him at 33, I'd buy that.
What about 33?
Yeah,
I don't like it at all.
I think 33 makes a lot of sense. To me, if you're the Cardinals or the Jets and you're getting him in those first few picks in the second round, that's what I would like from a value standpoint. I think the question is one of them going to get nervous and feel like they have to come up to the late first round? But to me, if you've already got someone to add, whether that's, I know Jeremiah Love keeps getting mocked to the Cardinals. So whether that's, okay, the Cardinals having an offensive player early on and the Jets having a defensive player early on, I think if you already have those guys, the same way that we saw the Giants with Jackson Dart last year move back into late first round at 25, but they already had Abdul Carter in there. And then you saw the Saints similarly get their left tackle and Calvin Banks and then come back at pick 40 and get Tyler Shuck. To me, that's the value, because then the pressure on them starting immediately is not there. And especially if you're the Jets right now and you have Geno in the building, I don't even know that a Ty Simpson would need to start this year. And I don't think it would be viewed as him being behind. Now, again, if you're Aaron Glenn, you might not like this plan because what's going to happen this year? And are you going to have the players to be able to compete? But in terms of building them, yes, we can say the 2027 draft is great, but there are a lot of things we thought about this year's draft that didn't come true. And so I do think there's an element of if you like Ty Simpson and you believe in his eventual potential, even if you don't think he's ready now, I think you should go with what you know in him now versus the question mark of what you hope to know next year in the quarterbacks there.
Yeah, it's a great point. But you have to, this is for me at least, you have to know that, you have to firmly believe, you don't know, but believe that Ty Simpson is going to be better than anything that you think you have a shot at next year with your three number ones. And Jory, you make a great point. Yeah, in all likelihood, he's not going to play ahead of Geno Smith. No, he might need to. Geno might get hurt. Geno might just be awful. And you go, what the heck? If we have this kid here, let's throw him in there. But I hate to use the phrase wasted pick. But if you think you're taking a quarterback next year and you have those three ones, aren't you better served taking, let's say it's 33 or 39 or 44, rather, beg your pardon, like a position player here that you know that can help? I also wonder, is Darren Mooji making the pick for himself? Like, is he confident enough that he's going to be there next year?
I think Darren Mooji.
Or is he making it? Yeah, I believe he is, and he should be. Or is he making it to win now for a coach that, you know, Woody Johnson is impatient. You know, some of the things Woody said last year during the season. Is he doing it now without the short-term interests in mind of his head coach? To me, that's the biggest question here. I know everyone says, it's synergy. We work together. Okay, sure, but.
Yeah, they're good questions, Andrew. I would say as it relates to Darren Mujeet's job security, I think if he didn't have the job security and the reassurance from Woody Johnson that he's got time to rebuild this thing, he wouldn't have traded nearly as much away as he has since he got on the job a little over a year ago. Now, with Aaron Glenn, the coach, that's a question, and we often see that there are coaches who are fired when the general managers keep their job. We've talked at length about, during the games, the coach is down on the sideline, the GMs were right there with the owner, the GM's kind of the intermediary between the owner and the team a lot of time. So fair or not, I do think that Darren Mooji's got at least through the 2027 season. I also think, to me, the question is not, do you think Ty Simpson right now is better than whatever you'll get next year with your three firsts? I think, and it's a good question that you set up, but the tweak that I would say is, do you think that Ty Simpson, after a year in an NFL building, and in theory, even in Frank Reich's offense and the offense that you have, do you think he will be better than one of the 2027 first round picks right away? Because to me, I am not primarily focused here on whether you get that fifth year on them and whether you get that. Like, I'm not concerned about the salary cap in 2030 for their quarterbacks. I don't care if you're getting a year to develop them. I care about what are they going to be able to do in 2027 and then after that in 2028 and 2029, because the Jets have been in such a quarterback desert for so long that it's not about the minutia here. It's just, can you find a quarterback and hit on it? And I would even argue that the same way the Jets messed up guys like Geno Smith and Sam Darnold, and I mean, Zach Wilson, the survey's still out. The other two have already had their resurgences, but the same ways that they set him up to failure, there's a chance that next year's 2027 quarterback could come up to the Jets and again be expected to play so quickly and thrive so quickly, despite a franchise not having success for so long, that they too would be set up to fail. Whereas I think there is a chance that if you have Ty Simpson in the building for a year, again, you have to think he's at least close physically and what his ceiling is. But if you give him a year and they finally give a quarterback a redshirt year, there might be a chance for the Jets to actually give a quarterback the development that they haven't been doing for so long.
Yeah, my only issue is just, okay, let's say this comes to pass, as you guys say, and you could, Andrew said it, you can start Geno all year. You don't have to start Ty Simpson, but I think it's the right plan for Ty Simpson. He needs to sit and learn. All right, next year you got the third pick of the draft. Dante Moore's on the board. Do you have the gall to pick him right after you pick Ty Simpson? You haven't seen Ty Simpson in a game yet. Preseason, maybe some meaningless snaps in the fourth quarters or whatever. If you have that conviction, sure. But I just think the opportunity cost is what bothers me, because I think when you draft somebody with a top 33 pick, you're then saying we're not drafting a quarterback in 2027. Unless you just want to flush a 33rd pick. Unless you just want to, if you want to say, we don't care, we just wasted the 33rd pick, which I know you hate that term, but it is wasting it if you draft two quarterbacks back to back. Then I'm actually okay with it, I guess. But then you've just wasted the 33rd pick who could be used to help Dante Moore or whatever quarterback bubbles up this year and becomes great and becomes a top five pick. So it's just, I just worry that they're going to, if you draft Ty Simpson that high, you're getting married to him. You're not dating, you're getting married. And it's different than Carson Beck in the fifth round. Like, you draft Carson Beck, whatever, you can move on easily. Nobody cares. You draft somebody 33, you're almost making a multi-year commitment there, I think.
I think it's also possible that, like, maybe you're getting married, but you also could get divorced in a year. And I mean, I was looking back at what was the value that the Cardinals got from Josh Rosen when they traded him to the Dolphins, and they got a second and fifth round pick. And again, the Jets are going to have other first round picks. So, like, if you end up going into the evaluation next year, it's not great for the guy's confidence who's already in the building. You could still go through the quarterback evaluations. It's good to know who guys are down the line. And then if you're so sure at that point that you feel like one of them is going to be way better and way better immediately or very quickly, then you just trade Ty Simpson. So, I mean, even Trey Lance and the Niners, I know they didn't get necessarily the same value, but I don't think it necessarily precludes you if you end up deciding after a year that Ty Simpson doesn't have the value that you thought. And, oh, by the way, then you've developed him for someone for a year.
Yeah, exactly. I think Ty Simpson's the big wild card here. Obviously, he is one of the many wild cards. Frank, you obviously have 12 storylines here. But, you know, the idea that the Cardinals are sitting right behind the Jets in the second round at 34, they may have to jump the Jets. John Schneider says he's willing to trade back at 32. And if you do that, then you get up to the bottom of the first round. You get that fifth year. You get that extra year on the rookie contract. Frank, you're also writing about, and Jory, I know you know plenty about, the Cowboys. Dallas is one of the six teams that has two number ones. They have 12 and 20. I am not buying the idea that Jerry's going all in and trading both picks and trying to move up into the top 10, because that has generally not been his MO of late. However, I could be wrong. The group think and the topic bars right now and all the screaming head shows the last 10 days all are pushing for Jerry to do something because we want the content. Frank, what do you think?
I think the Cowboys should, and I don't know if they will. And I've thought about this a lot since me, you, and Charles talked about it on the show, and I still have not wavered. I think that just hoping that somebody's there at 20 who's going to be an instant impact guy is just not my cup of tea in this draft. I go up and get the sure thing. And I usually wouldn't say that, but this draft is different. This draft does not have a lot of real impact guys. I think late first round is going to feel like the second round to me. Mm-hmm. I don't think the odds of Jerry hitting on the 20th pick and having a guy help their defense in that slot is really high. So I just say, move up, take Sonny Styles. It fits. It fits so well. I don't think they're going to miss this 20th pick. I really don't. And it gives us content too. I get that. But I just think for a team that, look, I am planting my flag already. I'm digging the hole. I've done this on teams before. I'm going to do it right now. Going to keep doing it throughout the whole offseason. I think Cowboys are going to be really good next year. Like, really good. Like maybe win the NFC East good. I think that they strike me as a team that can improve rapidly. Now that they've changed a coordinator, they've added some defensive talent. They're going to add more defensive talent in this draft. And to me, I want the one sure thing. Give me the one sure thing in this draft where there are really no sure things. I want the one sure thing in the top 10, and I don't think you can get that at even 12, much less 20.
It's an interesting question, Frank, because I think there is the element of the Cowboys' defense is more than one player away in order to be good, forget great. And so I think that as they're making this transition from 4-3 to 3-4, and I'll have an article up on Yahoo about this later, there's kind of this element of, do we have the size that we want at the defensive line? Do we have the guys who are able to read and react and communicate accordingly? Because they are going to be asked to do a little bit more thinking post-snap than that 4-3 was requiring. The Cowboys want to play a lot of five-man fronts this year. They want to make sure they've got their outside linebackers there. And they're from an inside linebacker standpoint, you really want the guy who's able to communicate. So yes, to have a great player would definitely elevate this. And obviously they're coming off. They lost Micah. They got Quinnen Williams in the building. They got Rashawn Gary in the building. I think for me, if you can get a great player at 12, which again, the last time, I don't know if it was the last time, but I believe the last time they drafted 12, and certainly a 12th overall pick they drafted recently, was Micah Parsons.
Yeah.
So if you can get a Micah Parsons-like player at 12, and then you can get like a really solid corner or safety or something like that at 20, to me, the defense will be better off. And those guys able to grow together at the beginning of the Christian Parker era, the new defensive coordinator in Dallas. To me, I think there's also this question of so much of the draft and what I would want to do if I were any team is based off where the runs on the positions go. So what the Cowboys should be doing with 12 and 20 is different if a bunch of receivers go high versus if a bunch of other defensive guys go high. I mean, I don't think they should pick an offensive tackle like they've done a lot of years, even though they play well. And the last thing to keep in mind is that the Cowboys don't have a second round pick.
Right.
And so if you say I'm packaging 12 and 20 and moving up, well, then you're getting one guy before the 92nd overall pick, round three. And I know there's some value to come in rounds two and rounds three, but I think that if you're saying, well, 20 is like a second rounder, they need their second rounder. They need to use that because they don't have an actual true second round pick this year.
Yeah, and a lot of people, and I've done this math before, I'll do it again for those who haven't heard previous episodes. A lot of people are projecting Browns, Cowboys swap. Cowboys go 12-6, Browns go 6-12. Fine, I don't buy that. But the price to go 12-6 is, in essence, a second round pick. Cowboys don't have a second round pick. So if that deal were to go down, the Browns would have to throw something in. Now, if Andrew Berry holds firm, and let's say this deal really happens and says, hey, 12-20, that's it, final offer. Like, you want it, you want it. And Jerry and Will McClay and Steven want to do that. That's fine. I just don't think that's reasonable, rational. I don't think that's going to happen. That's just not the way that I think the round is going to play out. There's also all these crazy scenarios as well. Like, I've played around with ESPN and PFF, like all the different draft mock simulators where, hey, let's tweak this pick and let's see how it falls. Let's tweak this pick and see how it falls. And to your point, Jory, about runs, like if I put a wide receiver at 6 to the Browns, then here comes the wide receiver run. If I put an offensive lineman at 6 to the Browns, you might get that offensive line run. The 10th overall pick now belongs to the Giants, not the Bengals. I do think that factors here a little bit for the Cowboys. I'm sure the Cowboys would love for the Giants to go defense at 5 and offense at 10, right? But who knows? And who knows how high they have to jump? Like, there's a scenario in which Sonny Styles is there at 6 for the Browns. Would they want him? Would Dallas want to jump? Do they have to get ahead of Washington at 7? Or does Washington just take the best player available because they have so many holes? And that's, again, to me, going back to the top of the segment, what makes this draft so fun and why everybody should read Frank's column right now about the 12 draft storylines. As a matter of fact, coming up on Inside Coverage, we're going to keep going through Frank's column. Jory has written extensively about Reuben Bain. Will Reuben Bain fall? And how many trades will we actually see? That's next on Inside Coverage. So I have a thank you to make here. Not only you, the listener, the watcher, thank you for liking and subscribing and sharing and writing a comment. Only the nice ones, please. So I want to thank you, the audience. And I also want to thank Frank, because I woke up this morning and I saw Frank's piece. I was like, oh my God, here's the show. Like, God bless Frank. The 12 storylines. It's beautiful. So Frank, let's keep going through your column. Reuben Bain, is he going to fall? He's really good at football. He has short arms. There's some off the field stuff that teams have known about forever. Multiple GMs, when they've done their press availabilities before the draft in the last week to 10 days, have said, we knew about the fatal car crash, which is tragic and awful, in 2024. We've known about it. We spoke to him, Reuben Bain, that is the Miami defensive lineman, at the combine about it. And most of these GMs have said on the record, those that wanted to speak about it on the record, that, you know, he's okay. In terms of, like, he's okay on our board, Brad Holmes, notably, one of them. There's a chance, though, that he could fall, Frank, and maybe not because of the off-the-field stuff, but because teams use comps, right? Whether they're AI comps or guys with an old notebook. And there aren't a lot of comps for a player playing defensive line with arms that short.
Yeah, I mean, none in the modern era with arms that short have been drafted at that position in the first round. I believe that that's still correct. And so, yes, the off-field stuff, very cynically, I don't think that matters. I think if Reuben Bain drops, it's going to be because he has short arms. Like, and we might look into it and say, oh, teams got really scared off about the car accident. We've seen guys do bad things before the draft and get drafted pretty much where they should get drafted. So cynically, I think it's about the arm length. And look, we could joke about it all we want. We could joke about quarterback hand size. We could joke about whatever you want, all these measurables, but they're benchmarks for a reason. There's a reason guys with short arms at edge rusher generally don't play that well, or why we talk so much about Will Campbell's arm length, because that matters at offensive tackle. So, yeah, I just wonder. I don't know if teams are playing coy and he's going to still end up going top 5-6 because he was a heck of a player in Miami. There's no question about that. And he's got a great motor and he really impacts the game in many, many ways. And you can see a smart defensive coach using him in many ways, versatile player. But I just don't know. He's the one guy who he could go 4, he could go 12. I have no idea. Him and Ty Simpson, I guess, are the two guys in this draft class where I'm just like, they could fall, they could go where, you know, really higher than we think, and nothing would surprise me because I think teams probably are all over the place with this guy. Just, and again, it's because of the arm length. It's just so unprecedented for somebody who doesn't hit that benchmark to be a really good edge rusher in the NFL.
Yeah, I think top 5 feels a little rich for me. Top 10 doesn't, but I also think that it's well within his range to be kind of like in that 8 to 20, I would say. I think what's interesting to me is I did a bunch of research on him last week, talked to evaluators from 5 teams regarding the car crash he was in 2024 when he was driving. A woman ended up in a coma and died a few months later and after never regaining consciousness. And so there's kind of, like we talked about, the off-field element, and then there's the arm length element. And as you guys were saying, if Reuben Bain falls, I had multiple teams tell me it will not be because of the fatality in the car crash. It will be because of his arm length. And even some people say like, oh, with that arm length, maybe he's better fit for a 4.3 than a 3.4. Like, what do you want to use him for? I mean, there's kind of a schematic fit element as well. I think we talked a little on the show last week about the idea of what is the ideal fit for guys. I had one team tell me that 32.5-inch arms is what they would be looking for at edge rusher. Anything below that would be considered below average. And I had a head coach tell me that 33-inch arms is what they're looking for at edge rusher. And so again, this isn't 32, it's 30 7/8 inches. Now, the piece of context to add to that, and I can't remember if I mentioned this last week, is that most guys who have remeasured at their pro days this year have had longer arms. They haven't had longer arms because the schools are kind of like trying to stack the boards for them. You have to remember, it is the NFL scouts in attendance at the pro days, not the school staff members, who are measuring them at their pro days. There are some questions in the community, the scouting community, I should say, the NFL community, about whether the measurements at the combine are accurate or if they are off to up to, in some cases, like an inch. And so I'm not trying to make it out like Reuben Bain's got 32.5-inch arms, but he might be in the 31s, which I think is a little less jarring for people than 30s. He did not choose to remeasure at his pro day. So I think that's kind of some context worth keeping in mind. But ultimately, when I talked to teams, they did talk to him. I mean, not everybody thought he was super upfront about this, but there's also the element of the statute of limitations for a wrongful death claim by Florida law is 2 years. And the woman who died in the car crash died June 13th, 2024. So there's still a couple more months of potential civil litigation that could be coming. And I think if anything, that's probably what teams worry about more than they worry about whether he had a history of drinking and driving under the influence and all of that. And I would say they view that legal situation as something to monitor rather as a reason to take him later. They do believe it's something that they can get through. So yeah, I'd be shocked if he goes after 20, but I think kind of 8 to 15, maybe 15 to 20. And if it's 15 to 20, it's probably because a run on receivers or something like that, or offensive tackles went early.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the window for the civil suit, because listening back to a pod from last week or 2 weeks, whenever we first discussed this story and broke down your well-researched and well-reported article, I think I mistakenly said that the civil matter had been settled. It is not. It still is possible there. So thanks for noting that. That certainly does factor here in all of this. I'm looking at the board and I'm saying Tennessee, I think that's a little bit too rich. Could the Giants? Maybe at 5, probably too rich, but I think the window's like 5 to 14. I mean, he's exactly the kind of edge setter that Jesse Minter would love in his defense. You have Trey Hendrickson, but his job is go find quarterback and not necessarily stop the run. To me, that's the window. He could go lower, clearly, here. I've also had plenty of, and this goes back to even during the season, I've had plenty of personnel guys say they think he's going to kick inside. And I don't mean full time, but that if you go NASCAR package, if you put him inside on third down and you're rushing Andrew the passer, that he's a three technique and he's got great quickness and great power and good moves inside. So I think he's a versatile player, but look, in no way is he Arvell Reese, in no way is he David Bailey, right? Who look like your classic edge. He is not that guy. But turn on the playoff and watch Reuben Bain whip people. He is a difference maker, and he's a tough, tough player. Let's talk about the Chiefs here, because Frank, you're writing about the Chiefs. They are, like the Cowboys, one of the six teams that have multiple first-round picks. Kansas City's first pick is 9, which is just nuts, considering they have Patrick Mahomes, but they didn't make the playoffs. Obviously, people think the dynasty is over. It is not over. I just think it is on pause. And then they have the Trent McDuffie pick, which came from the Rams. That pick is 29. They also, Frank, have a lot of needs. And I think they probably, talking to the Chiefs here, have more needs than the average fan thinks. They need two corners, both corners left. They need a wide receiver. They could use an edge rusher. They could probably use some help on the defensive line in general. Their offensive line could always use some help. So where do the Chiefs go? Or more importantly, how badly do they need to nail these two picks?
Yeah, and I think you hit on it in the question of, is the Chiefs dynasty over or is it on pause? And that's why the Chiefs are interesting to me, because they got to hit these picks. For a team that has been such, you know, before last season, obviously, has been such a consistent winner, they do have a lot of holes. They have a lot of issues they have to address, which happens in a salary cap league. You're going to lose some players. Their first top 10 pick since Patrick Mahomes, 2017. So they haven't had a chance to draft this high. And maybe they'd rather have it in a better class than this one. But still at 9, you should be able to get a guy who impacts the game right away. Is Reuben Bain? He seems like a really good fit for them, right?
Because
goes him and Karlaftis at each side. I think that's pretty good. I love Caleb Downs. I think Caleb Downs might be the best player, period, in this draft. And they do need secondary help because
they lost Brian Cook. Forget about the corners. Brian Cook went home to Cincinnati.
Exactly. You lose 3 or 4 defensive backfield starters from last year. That's a need all of a sudden. And also the 29th pick. You got to hit that. I think this draft is going to shape how we answer the question of, is the Chiefs dynasty still going, or do we just see the end of it? I think they have to hit these picks, because all of a sudden you look at that roster and the improving division, by the way, too, and you say, wow, there's some real holes with the Chiefs that Patrick Mahomes can't fix them all, especially coming off an ACL maybe. So very interested to see what the Chiefs do and how they approach these picks.
Yeah, if I'm the Chiefs, I'm taking this week in the facility to like listen to music that came out in 2022, to watch newscasts that came out into 2022, and just try and recreate whatever they were drinking in 2022 when they got not only guys like Trent McDuffie in the first, George Karlaftis up there, Sky Moore in the second, but also when you go all the way down to the 7th round, they had Jalen Watson in the secondary and Isaiah Pacheco at running back. And to me, that's kind of what they want to recreate. I would say that yes, the Chiefs need to hit on the draft, but to me, while ideally they hit on their first round, or they have shown some ability to find these gems later. So to me, it's more about what they do over this draft weekend in aggregate than specifically in the first round. But because they have so much capital in the first round, that's where it begins. And just kind of remembering that they have a secondary staff and a defensive staff that has historically really maximized and developed young DBs. And so remembering that even if there's not someone who's already a finished product, I do trust Dave Merritt and that group to develop them.
I thought they would be playing 1989 music. No.
Also a good option.
Okay.
See what we Jory did has no idea what 1989
is. No, no. Like we have Derek Thomas that year in the Hall of Fame at the 4th overall pick, according to Pro Football Focus, which I totally knew off the top of my head.
You do know what I'm talking about, right? Frank does.
I don't know. What are you talking about, Andrew?
Okay. Just 1989, one of Taylor Swift's greatest albums, guys. And 1989.
Oh, look at that. We both
I was thinking
it.
Of like 1985 song.
Gosh.
Did I just pull a Taylor reference and I'm the only one that gets it?
I feel bad I didn't get that one. Well done, sir. Well done.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
We'll work on it.
I did see the 1989 tour for the record at Levi Stadium, but don't judge me. Anyway.
It was awesome. I wouldn't judge you for that.
Sure you would. The Chiefs, they have 9, 29, 40, 74, 109. So they have 5 picks in the top 109. They're 3 picks for Trent McDuffie. There's also a 5 and a 6, not to mention that other first round pick at number 29. And that was a trade, obviously, a big trade. Another one of the veteran pieces moved before this draft for a first round pick. As mentioned, 6 teams with multiple first round picks. Frank, you are also writing about how many trades we'll actually see. Brett Veach, yeah, GM of the Chiefs, I don't think he's just trying to drive ratings. I do think he's trying to make his phone ring, which is a different issue. So I think we're going to see a lot of trades. Do you? Because teams have to want blue chip players to move up and trade. Or there's the other theory, and that is there's only so few legitimately good players that teams are willing to give up later assets later in this draft to get the handful of good players they think are in this draft.
Yeah, and I hate to disagree with Brett Veach. He knows a lot more than me, but I do disagree with him when he says he thinks there's going to be a lot of trades. I see the big impediment here is the 2027 draft, which I also wrote about as one of my storylines because it's rare.
Two topics together here. Frank, look what you did.
Exactly. Read the segue. It's rare for next year's draft to overshadow this year's draft. Really rare. I can't really remember too many instances of it happening, but you're going to hear a lot about the 2027 draft. You already have. We've talked about that vis-a-vis quarterbacks. And what happens when teams want to move up? The obvious thing is either give up picks in this draft or give up picks in next year's draft. And I think when teams say, hey, we want to move up, the other team is going to say, okay, we'll take your 2027 pick in this round. And they're going to say, nope, that's a non-starter. We're not trading 2027 picks. That makes no sense to us. So I think that cuts off one of your avenues right there. And we talked about this draft class not being that great. If we're being honest, why would teams want to move down and collect more picks in this draft? So it's like, oh, yeah, sure, we'll take two picks in this year's draft for one better pick in this year's. I don't see that really happening that often. And I don't think there's a lot of veterans who are going to move either. Maybe one or two, but now that Dexter's moved on, I don't think we're going to see a ton of veteran trades either. So I just don't see the avenues for a lot of trading. I think any team that trades, like the Falcons did last year to the Rams when they traded the next year's first, any team that does that with a 2027 pick of similar value, we will mock them. We will make fun of them. That ain't happening.
I'll quote Todd McShay. He was on a DJ, Daniel Jeremiah, recently. He said, it's a fireable offense. If you trade a 2027 one, it is a fireable offense.
Absolutely. So that cuts off, even seconds and thirds are going to be pretty valuable in that draft, more so than this draft. So that just cuts off an avenue right there. And I just don't think teams are going to be wanting to load up picks in this year's draft either. So I think very, very few trades, but we'll see. Maybe Brett Veach is right. And we're going to see a flurry. It's always hard to predict.
Yeah, I disagree. I think we will see a lot of trades. I think there's this element of the league has become so much more trade happy. I mean, think about Micah Parsons goes one place, Quinnen Williams goes another, Sauce Gardner goes a third. These are all premier players who have been traded recently. And because of that, the allocation of draft picks currently is very skewed to certain teams. Some teams have a lot. I mean, again, six teams with multiple first round picks not only means that teams are in certain places of their rebuild, but I also would say that the same way, Andrew, you mentioned earlier, this idea of, oh, well, if this trade wants to happen, it's not the exact right value. The more picks you have, the more you're able to get to a fair value of what works. And I'm talking about 2026 in particular. Yes, there are going to be people who want 2027. I would say that there are some teams that believe that they're in their window now. So waiting for next year and a 2027 player that might not really hit their stride till 2028 and 2029 is not as valuable. And I also think that all of the draft is so heavily hinging on supply and demand that if so many teams are like, we don't want to trade up because we're waiting for 2027, that there's going to be someone who wants to exploit that market inefficiency and say, I'm able to trade up 25 spots or 10 spots, whatever it is, whichever round, because other teams are so nervous about their 2027 that maybe I'm giving up a 2027 second round pick, which I'm willing to do because otherwise this trade is not normally possible. So I don't know. I just think that the draft is such an inexact science that to feel like anything is so sure, including the 2027 talent pool, is a little bit, not naive to me, but it is a little bit too confident for my comfort.
Yeah, it's a really good point because as we said, there could be a dozen quarterbacks right now, a dozen. I can tell you there are a dozen, 10 to 12, that the personnel people are talking about potentially being in next year's first round. Inevitably, some of them will get hurt. Inevitably, some of them will stay in school. Ty Simpson said this week he was offered $6.5 million to go to Miami and not enter the draft. He was leaving Alabama, $6.5 million, go to Miami, right? Good chance he's making more money at Miami than he is next year. Now, you have to look at the total deal, but if he's not a first-round pick, if he falls to the second, he's getting paid, but not $6.5 million in year number one. So that's certainly a factor, and there will inevitably be quarterbacks that currently are not on our radar who jump into the conversation with a great, great 2026 college football campaign. Fernando Mendoza being a perfect example. Cam Ward.
You know, could I real quick? I need example. To shout
now, out. Both something. Were on our radar a year before they got drafted, but no one saw either as the potential Frank number one overall pick.
I need to shout out Nate Tice because I had forgotten this. And Nate Tice, obviously our teammate on Wisconsin, all that too. Last year, I was looking up old mock drafts because I was like, just doing, you know, research on stuff. And I was like, where do people have Fernando Mendoza? Nobody had Fernando Mendoza as a first round pick in their way too early mock drafts. You know, the ones that come out days after.
Yeah.
Nate Tice had Fernando Mendoza as his number three overall player.
Good for him.
Quarterback one. He nailed that. Props to you, Nate, my fellow Badger. I just need to shout that out because I was so impressed that Nate was like so far. Like nobody else even had Fernando Mendoza as a first round guy. And here's Nate, has him as top three guy.
Yeah, and you know what? Let's use that to tell everyone to go listen. Nate's been on the show and we've been on Nate's show, but let remind everyone, go listen to Football 301 and Yahoo Sports Daily, all the great Yahoo pods, but Football 301 is one of my daily listens. You need to make it one of yours as well. Nate is great. C-Mac is great. Harmon's great. The whole crew is great. And you could have heard about Fernando Mendoza when he was just that kid getting his butt whooped at Cal before transferring to Indiana. So there's that. The other thing, too, that this just nuts to me, you mentioned the six trades already. And I once years ago, and it went viral back like before things truly went viral, I was on NFL Network trying to explain in a similar situation that all these teams have X percentage of the first round. Well, six teams with those 12 picks own 37.5% of the first round. Six teams. So I'm actually going to get that right here. That's kind of nuts to me. And it's going to go fast. Like, it's going to be an 8-minute first round. All the GMs have been asked about this week. They all say, no big deal. That's fine. Don't care about it. I think some of the GMs are actually happier about it. But if these trades happen, the framework is generally in place before you're on the clock. It's going to be slightly different if a team just out of the blue calls up while the other team's on the clock and says, hey, we want to make a deal, because you do have 20% less time this year to potentially make that deal. Now, throughout the week, throughout the last couple of weeks, if not the GMs, very often the assistant GMs or maybe the cap guys, that's how this works. They reach out, they'll call, they'll text and say, hey, if you want to get out when you're on the clock, what would it look like to come down to here and to at least dip their toe in the waters so that if you do call when that team is actually on the clock, it's not the very first time you're having the conversation. That's not always how it works, but that's often how the sausage is made. I'm for trades. I'm for trades. I'm also for not tipping picks. There are certain accounts, and Schrager went on a soapbox about this recently on the Twitter. There's certain accounts.
He sure did.
Yeah. People that I follow, you could agree or disagree with it. I'm a big fan of eye on the prize, like, and enjoying it, because sometimes these picks do come in 4 or 5 minutes early. Whatever. More information is better. However you want to do it. There are certain accounts, some of them I consider friends, that I will mute at 8 o'clock Eastern time. Am I the only one that does that?
Maybe.
Yes.
I'm fine with getting them early.
Yes.
I haven't tipped a pick before because I haven't had that kind of intel, but I think that there are a lot of different ways that people succeed in this very crowded media landscape. Yes. And so the people who are tipping the picks, that is one of their ways. And so, I mean, I love you, Andrew. And I have respect for Peter, but I kind of, when he said it and he currently works for NFL Network, I'm like, okay, great. Well, you have the league behind you leaking, like the league leaks stuff to NFL Network all the time. And so it's easy to say that.
I didn't see his full rant. I saw that he did.
Or whatever, ESPN, their whole ESPN, thing. So I mean, yes, it's all I do know that there have been consequences for people who leaked picks, but I don't begrudge. It is silly.
I don't begrudge if you want to do it. My viewing enjoyment, I prefer. It's like there's latency now in all the different ways in which we consume content in our homes, right? Satellite, cable, most of us streaming. And so you're going to get a different feed. Like, I mean, the TV in one room in your home might be different than the TV in the other room in your home. And then if you have your laptop open, you sometimes see the tweets from our colleagues who are at the game in the press box, 7, 8, 10, 15, depending on your latency. Hope it's not 15, get new internet before it appears on your screen at home. That's really the way this whole thing is. Very rarely are people tipping picks 5, 6, 7 minutes in advance. That's just not the case. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Coming up a little bit later, though, we'll tell you about how you can watch the draft with us here at Yahoo, because we got something cooking for you as well. Coming up next, however, Jory is in Cleveland, and she's very happy about it. She's going to empty the notebook. What she saw today at Browns minicamp, voluntary, of course, and she's going to do it voluntarily on Inside Coverage. It's Inside Coverage on Yahoo. I have always said, and I'm not the only one who says it, I didn't come up with this, and I said this today with Cedric Tillman, Browns wide receiver. I said it to him because we are on a Zoom doing something. I said, it's not real football if you're still in shorts. That said, this was pretty close because the Browns today had a voluntary veteran minicamp, which the new head coaches are allowed to do. Todd Monken, one of the new head coaches. And on the week of the draft, Jory Epstein was there. In Berea, Ohio, from where she joins us now, technically Middleburg Heights, Ohio, where the Browns had Shedeur Sanders, Deshaun Watson, and Dillon Gabriel on the field today playing the football. What'd you see, Jory?
Yeah, it was really interesting. It was fun to get an actual practice in April. This was not like a 20 minutes of individual drills. We had 7-on-7. We had 11-on-11. I know that Deshaun Watson, in theory, returned to practice in December. It was the first time I had seen him practice since he tore his Achilles in October of 2024, had surgery, and then re-tore it and had additional reconstruction surgery in January 2025. Obviously, there wasn't contact. This wasn't like full-on physicality, but this was, I feel like for quarterbacks, receivers, and DBs, that's who it's most valuable for, a practice like this. And he looked smooth. He was moving fluidly, whether that was for a handoff or a transition or throwing on the run. There definitely were not visible signs with this degree of football of his Achilles tear. I thought it was interesting that the Browns intentionally structured the practice so that Shedeur Sanders and Deshaun Watson would both get first-team reps. Dillon Gabriel, also still on the roster for them, did not get any first-team reps. Shedeur got more first team reps, which was also intentional. And I would say that there wasn't necessarily a huge difference between what the two looked like at the quarterback position. Shedeur had an interception on a deep ball that he threw to Malachi Corley. Malachi kind of was stutter-stepping toward the end. The DB ends up getting it deep. Deshaun did not throw an interception, but did have a pass broken up by Quincy Williams. And then Dillon Gabriel had a pass intercepted. So those were all between 7-on-7 and 11-on-11. Head coach Todd Monken still said he really liked the command that the quarterbacks were showing at practice. He felt it was up to par. And then we did talk to Shedeur Sanders and Dillon Gabriel after practice. And yeah, it was interesting talking to Shedeur, but among the things he said was that he was not in control of the quarterback competition, so he wanted to compete against himself. He didn't really give playbook insights when offered, but did say that he knows how to learn and that the coaches are embracing him. And what I thought was not an unintentional comment, he said that about him learning, he knows how he learns, and and how could anybody get to this level without knowing how to learn? And so if someone thinks that a player doesn't know how to learn, maybe that's about whether that person knows how to communicate or teach. Make of that what you will. There's a lot going on. And then also worth noting, Myles Garrett was not here. Todd Monken has talked to him. He's made it clear that he prefers guys at all of these offseason activities, but he knows it's voluntary. He said he texted with Myles Garrett. Myles was not the only guy not here. Todd is pretty honest, and he's not willing to say what he prefers for accountability while also recognizing that there are NFL and NFLPA rules surrounding whether or not you can compel guys to be here.
Probably has a 23 sack rule. If you get 23 sacks in a season, you can skip.
Miles is here in Southern California. He was seen, and he posted on the red carpet with his beautiful significant other, the great Olympian, the great gold medalist, Chloe Kim, as they were here for the premiere of the Michael Jackson biopic. So Miles is also courtside Saturday for the Cavaliers game one victory over the Raptors. He is a minority partner in the Cavaliers. Frank, the floor is yours.
I think the interesting guy here is obviously Deshaun Watson. I've let my feelings be known about Deshaun Watson. They're pretty strong. I think it's ridiculous that the Browns are even entertaining this. It's nonsense. Watson can't play and he's not a great guy. What? Why catering to his feelings? What? Because you have this sunk cost into him? It's a sunk cost. You're not getting that money back if he starts a quarterback in week one. I don't know why they're entertaining this. I'd rather play either of the two young guys. I'd rather play guy off the street. I'd rather play anybody you draft on Thursday, Friday, or Saturday. I don't get what this whole Deshaun Watson thing is all about, but hey, I'm not running the Browns. So that's my two cents on the Browns quarterback situation. It will not change. I am dug in. The Deshaun Watson ship sailed years ago, and for them to keep going back to this well is, I think, embarrassing as a franchise. I'm sorry about that, Andrew, but it is what it is. We'll see. Maybe Deshaun Watson's going to be good again after 7 years of not being good and being a bad citizen too, but who knows? I mean, weirder things have happened, I guess, in the NFL.
All right, let me offer this. Hearing what you said, hearing what you both said, he is on the roster. They can't cut him. So they're trying to win some football games. They're trying to get anything out of that contract. They made the playoffs, obviously, in 2023. And Deshaun's first half of this season, his first 10 games, was certainly a huge part of it. They had 7 wins when he got hurt. And in that final week 10 game in Baltimore, he played his best football as a Brown. Now that, if he were to start week one, would have been 34 months since his quote-unquote best football. And roughly 22 months since the last time he stepped on a field in a real game for the Browns. That was at Huntington Bank Field when he tore his Achilles. And there were some cheers and some jeers when he was taken on a cart into the locker room. You know what happened? They did not make the playoffs in 2024. They have won only 5 games, or rather 8 games the last 2 years. They won 5 this past year. Either way. So let's look at it from this perspective. Todd Monken is a brand new head coach. You can't just hand Shedeur Sanders nor Dylan Gabriel the job, for that matter. One of them has to earn it. Deshaun Watson's on the roster, so he is going to get a chance to earn it. And Frank, while I hear what you say about saying, hey, why would I put him on the field? As a new head coach, you cannot tell that new head coach to stand in front of your team and have it be anything other than a meritocracy. Every job is open with any coach, but especially with a new head coach, because a new head coach instantly loses credibility if he stands up there and says something other than the player who wins the job will play. And if ownership were to tell him, or anyone in the front office were to tell him, hey, you can't play that guy, he's off limits, then I think that sends a different message as well. I think it sends a message to the veterans if potentially one of the two younger quarterbacks, both now in year two, doesn't seem capable of winning games, which is always a possibility. That it's just pragmatic there for me to say that. So he's going to have a chance to win the job. If Shedeur Sanders or Dylan Gabriel beats him out, that's what's going to happen. If Deshaun Watson starts week one, it's because he is clearly the better quarterback and he wins the job. No quarterback wins a job on April 21st. It just doesn't happen. Now, could you have the number one overall pick in any year later in that week, the third week of April, quote unquote, win the job? Sure. Like Jaden Daniels 2 years ago when Dan Quinn came out. Of course,
he wasn't named until at least the end
of the season. He wasn't. You're right. And thank you for clarifying. But Marcus, there have been a number of coaches who just go, guys, of course he was going to play. He's done everything. He checked the box. And after the fact, say yes. Now they had to go win that job.
Caleb Williams was handed to him. I'm not saying that was unfair.
That was the bad example. Correct. Yeah, but Caleb Williams was handed to him by Matt Eberflus. Yes, thank you for cleaning that up. So that's how they're going to play it out. I don't know who's going to win. I get asked every bleeping day, but it's going to be a legitimate competition for better or for worse.
Yeah, and Andrew, to your point, Todd Monken actually was asked today about the two-way quarterback competition or two-person quarterback competition, and he said that he was not going to be calling it that. He was going to let the competition play itself out. The question I have for you guys is, I obviously am not around the Browns as much as Andrew is, but I was here in June for minicamp last year, and at the time there were 4 quarterbacks in the building: Joe Flacco, Kenny Pickett, Dylan Gabriel, and Shedeur Sanders, and that was the depth chart in that order at that time. Joe Flacco was not getting any first team reps or really many reps at all in June because their philosophy was he knows the offense. Yeah. He knows this game. We don't need to give him time. Kenny Pickett, they were trying to see what they had in him. Ultimately, they would trade him. Then you get to Dylan Gabriel, who was kind of like slowly getting it in, and they felt like Shedeur Sanders was behind. I'm curious how you guys would structure the rep allocation this time because no one has a pre-existing knowledge of the offense. Mm-hmm. No one is Joe Flacco level experienced. And then to me, there's an element of, well, Deshaun still has a much deeper bank of mental reps, but he doesn't have as current a bank as mental reps. And then on top of that, Frank, to your point about what's he going to do, and Andrew, you were talking about this too, I think there's an element that there's a very real situation where Deshaun Watson looks far and away the best player in training camp, just in terms of his understanding and command of the offense and what he's physically able to do, but that's not necessarily what's best week one because there's not going to be the same level of live rush. So if you guys were running this, how would you structure and how would you try and simulate what does that Achilles actually do when the Myles Garrett equivalent is coming to sack you? Because you're not going to get that in training camp practices.
I think the answer is, Jordan, you're going to see each of these three quarterbacks get legitimate reps in the preseason.
Yeah.
You're not going to get the fourth quarterback, the camp arm, be the guy that's going to carry you through these three preseason games. They're going to have one with the Bills. They're going to have a joint practice with the Bills as well. So you'll certainly get reps in a joint practice for all three quarterbacks. But I think what we saw today is a hint of what's to come, and that it's for right now, Deshaun and Shedeur, and then Dylan Gabriel is clearly in the third position. Monken has made it clear that he doesn't say he wants to name a starter before training camp the third week of July, but he would like someone who is clearly the starter, and then they could lose that job. Somebody could pass him in training camp, but he wants to have a feel, whether it's announced or not, and we'll know by the reps when they get out there in July as to who's the guy. And that process started
today. My answer will be different. I would split up the reps by saying, Deshaun, you see that field over there?
I know you.
Yeah, we're sending a quality control guy with you. Have fun, play around, act like you're on the team, but you're never going to see the light of day. We sold our soul for you, and you, basically stabbed us in the back, and we don't want you around anymore, but we have to have you here. So
I love you, Frank.
Going to be remotely diplomatic about this situation.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's ridiculous.
That is reasonable. So, Frank, I would ask you on a question I think that you're probably going to be more interested in entertaining. You mentioned Myles Garrett not being there, and you kind of joked of like, oh, well, 23 sacks, you don't have to be there. Do you think that actually should be, again, not a policy because it says voluntary, but to me, there's an element that if Myles Garrett's not at voluntary camps, he's still going to individually be at the peak of his performance, but the team might not best reach its ceiling if everyone's not on the same field. There is a new defensive coordinator. There are some new guys. So I'm curious, like, do you care at all that Myles Garrett is not there? And do you think it will impact the Browns' ability to win in 2026?
A little bit, just because, like you said, it's better than not that Myles Garrett is there. But I do think, look, we've all covered sports for a long time. Doesn't matter the sport. Superstars have their own set of rules. It just is the case. Sure. And Myles Garrett is maybe the biggest superstar in the NFL right now, maybe the best player in the NFL right now. So if he wants to stay away, he's going to be ready. And I think that's the big part of it. And if it'd be different if he was a quarterback who you need to get some form of a lot more defensive linemen still need chemistry. I get that. But a lot more chemistry with your receivers if you're a quarterback. So I'm fine with Myles Garrett staying away because he's a superstar. Superstars get different rules. That's just the way it's been for decades and decades. But to your point, yeah, in a perfect world, if you could check a box, is Myles here or Myles not here?
Yeah,
much rather have him be here. I just think it's fine.
And from players and from coaches when they get to new places and they're like, the best players are the hardest workers and the ones they're the most, and it sends a message, and it sounds cliche when they say it, but I do think there are times, and I mean, I remember being at training camp years ago about in West Virginia with the Browns when I thought Myles Garrett had the day off, and then I asked him about it after and he's like, what do you mean I was practicing? I'm like, were you though? And again, I'm not saying that he's not physically there, and maybe you make the argument that from an injury standpoint he's better off not doing it. I just, And maybe I'm also a little bit skewed because my first 7 years in this league, I was around the Cowboys, and that was kind of Dak's MO. And I'm not saying he was their most talented player at the time, but he was the quarterback and the leader. But I feel like if I'm on this Browns team and I want to win, there's kind of this element of you don't have a quarterback leader right now. You have a serious void in leadership from a lot of positions, in my opinion. And Myles Garrett has the opportunity to step up and fill it and kind of bring everyone up with him and show them what he's doing. And even if he's doing the same work at home, to see someone doing it there and to see like, hey, Myles has the talent. He's not winning the same way we hear. I mean, I think Max Crosby is the type of guy who's doing what I'm describing. But I think there's kind of an element of it sets a tone.
Yeah, no, there's a lot there to unpack. Let me, because we're kind of short on time, just put it this way. Myles, when he's in the building, is probably as hardworking a guy as there is. He takes his time. He's given his off time. He takes it. Yes, they would prefer him there. They've made that perfectly clear. Andrew Berry said yesterday on the record with my broadcast partner, Nathan Zagura, in a long interview you can see on clevelandbrowns.com, that they've been texting frequently. They've texted about the Cavs. They've texted about draft plans, that he's fine. Yeah, he'd like him there. No one's hiding that they like him there. Myles is not the only guy that isn't there, however. Denzel Ward, Grant Delpit, notably missing as well. Jerry Jeudy is not there. Deshaun Watson, Jerry Jeudy have been working out together in Florida. It should also be noted, and this has actually been documented, and there's visual evidence of it as well. Myles, the last couple of years, has like flown all the defensive linemen, especially the young guys, at his expense to Texas, put them up in his house, fed them, taken care of them for a week, and like they've all worked out at his house, kind of like a pass rush clinic. So he has certainly shown off-field, off-season leadership. He's just not getting perfect attendance marks for the off-season program. When it's mandatory minicamp, he will be there. When it's mandatory OTAs, he will be here. Would they like him there more, especially with the new head coach? Yeah, they've said that. But they're going to be cool with it, and this is the way that they've handled it, and it's the way it is. All right, we have time for one more thing before we go. Frank, after the musical accompaniment, my friend, what do you have?
The house band in fine form. Let's go to a player I actually want to talk about. Trent Williams on Monday signed a 2-year, $50 million extension. And I think it's just time to realize we are watching one of the greatest players in NFL history, maybe the greatest offensive lineman in NFL history. I know Walter Jones, Anthony Munoz. There's a bunch of guys in that conversation. But what Trent Williams has done over his career is absolutely phenomenal. That when that trade was made, Washington sent him to San Francisco. He's obviously disgruntled at the time, for a third and a fifth round pick. And part of the low value in that was, well, he's 32 years old. How much longer does he got? Well, he's going to be 38 this year, just signed a deal worth $25 million a year, and is still one of the best players in the NFL. I love watching Trent Williams play. The amount of violence he plays with at that position, and also athleticism and everything you want out of not only an offensive tackle, but a football player. That is Trent Williams, 12 Pro Bowls to his resume. He's going to walk into the Hall of Fame. I just wanted to tip my cap because Jory pointed out how old I am. I wanted to tip my cap to a fellow old guy. Trent Williams, still getting it done, still at the top of his game. And I know, you know, we don't watch offensive linemen play to play generally. Watch Trent Williams because it's a treat. He is one of the best players I've ever seen in this game.
Love it. Jory, what do you got?
Yeah, so I have spent an inordinate amount of time in recent years thinking about NFL players and coaches and their names. So today I have a social media post that I think is hilarious from the Los Angeles Rams Reddit thread. And it says, the fact the Rams currently have Lake, Rivers, and Waters on the team means they're going to draft D'Angelo Pons in the second. It just makes sense. Mm-hmm. So I love that. I also think it means that if Jimmy Garoppolo retires, that Philip Rivers might need to leave his high school gig and come be their backup quarterback. And if you're wondering whether I spent time on Pro Football Reference figuring out fountains and my friend John Machado's got Marsh, there was no stream on Pro Football Reference. I did check. Brooke, there are some options. So I could go on and on, but I'm pro hydration, I'm pro name play, so I hope the Rams draft D'Angelo Pons for this reason and this reason only.
I hope so. Also, he's a heck of a football player. He's undersized, but he's a dog, and they need corners. Kobe Durant left. He could fit that role. I think he would be great. And if he does get drafted, my one more thing is that you should see it and get the analysis and watch the draft with us, because we're going to put on a big show coming up on Thursday. We will be live at 8 p.m. Eastern time during night number one, and not just night number two. We're doing it night number two as well. The NFL draft live show right here on yahoosports.tv, wherever the Yahoo Sports YouTube page as well, that you get your streaming Yahoo content. It's going to be me and Nate Tice and Charles McDonald and Matt Harmon and C-Rob and Jason Fitz. It'll be a cast of thousands. Where did they get that headshot of me? I have no idea where they got that, but that looks fantastic. Well done, whoever dug that up. I may have to start using that. We are live at 8 p.m. Eastern time on Thursday, and I'm looking forward to it. Happy draft, Frank. Happy draft, Jory. When next we speak, it'll be
a lot of players will be on a lot of teams.
Yeah, I'm kidding. In all seriousness, friends, travel safely. Enjoy the draft. We thank everyone for listening, liking, subscribing, and all those fun things. My name is Andrew Siciliano. For Frank and Jory, so long, everybody.